This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we bring you more interviews from the Farnborough 2016 Air Show. You'll hear about the FA-18, the F-16, the PBY, and the P-8. In the news, we discuss the future of wide-body airliners, the U.S. Air Force pilot shortage, JetBlue air turbulence, an F-22 grounded by bees, and an evacuation at a JFK terminal. That, listener recordings, and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 414 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is first Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. Back again from Florida and going there again next week. Or this week. I'm sorry. I get so confused.
I think you spend more time in the air than you do on the ground.
It seems that way, but I love it.
All right. That's good. That's a good thing. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hey, good evening. I'm a bit tired. We have a little bit of a story. I went flying for the first time in 2 years today. So open cockpits suck the life out of you, but it's really enjoyable.
Oh, you've been up in the air too. Max Trescott, our CFI author, glass cockpit expert. I bet you've been up in the air as well.
Oh, yeah, twice already today. And I'm now halfway to being licensed as a drone operator, too. So it's been a busy weekend.
That's right. We're going to talk to you about that this week, later this week on the UAV Digest, I think.
Exactly.
You're lined up to join us as our guest. So it'll be great to talk about your experiences doing that. And some of the folks listening to this show might be interested in that as well. So end of the week, take a look at the UAV Digest. com. Also joining us from Portland, Maine, our main man, Micah. Hey, Micah.
Hello, everyone. Good to be here again. Thanks for inviting me along.
What is this, three in a row now?
I think it's four, but who's counting?
Is it really?
And no Rob, you must have chased him away.
Oh, yes. No Rob tonight. Rob is traveling. We expect to have him back next week. The reason Micah's here is that we've got some more interviews that Micah and Brian brought back from Farnborough, so we're going to talk about those. That instead of having a guest this episode.
Oh, I thought I was here because you liked having me on the show.
No.
Son of a gun.
Sorry, Micah.
Yeah. Well, we do have some more interviews from Farnborough concerning the FA-18, the F-16, the PBY, and the P-8. So we're going to start with those, and then we'll take a look at some of the aviation news from the past week. So with that, is everyone ready to get started?
Ready.
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Well, let's get started with our continuing special report from Farnborough 2016. This first one is a conversation about the FA-18. Brian, Micah, can you set this one up for us?
Well, Brian and I were invited by Carlos and Matt, a Plane Talking UK, to go through the air show with them, showing them some static displays and talk a little bit about the aircraft and what was special about them. So this is me and Brian talking with Matt about the FA-18, and I'm sure that I have made a number of mistakes, and I hope, David, that when I do, you will correct them for me when we get done.
Yeah, and this interview was a follow-on to the engine discussion that we had. So we looked at the engine on static display, then went over to the aircraft. So the continuation in the timeline of that.
So we've moved to a different aircraft now, and we are standing in front of...
This is the FA-18 Super Hornet. And there are two things that are important about what I just said. A lot of people refer to the F-18, and they say F-18 Hornet. That's a different airplane.
Right. The F-18 is a predecessor of the Super Hornet, and they were both F-A-18s, so I'll get to that in a moment. But the Hornet was a predecessor of the Super Hornet. The Super Hornet is practically a completely different aircraft, but they still call it the Hornet. One of the big secrets that I learned about how to tell the difference between a Hornet and a Super Hornet is the shape of the air intake right behind me. And you can see that it's square. That means it's a Super Hornet. The older Hornets, the original Hornets, the air intake was round. And whenever I'm watching TV and I'm looking at the aircraft and I see a Hornet, that's how I can tell there's a difference between a Super Hornet and a Hornet. The other thing, this is a carrier-based aircraft. It's for the Navy and the Marines, and they fly it. This is the aircraft that the F-35 is going to replace. So it's an older aircraft, but the F-35, they're not able to roll them out quite as fast as they had hoped. So they're actually taking F-A-18s out of the boneyard, reconditioning them, and putting them back into service in order to fill the mission role that we need to serve until we can really get enough F-35s up and flying. And the other thing I said in the beginning was I said it's an F-A-18. F stands for fighter. A stands for attack. When you talk about an F-16, that's a fighter. That does do ground support, but it's predominantly for air-to-air combat. The A is for attack and for ground attack, like the A-10. The A-10 is an attack aircraft designed for ground attack. The F-A-18 is fighter and attack and designed to be able to do both. And it's also the aircraft that our good friend Captain Nick flew after the F-4.
And it's all coming full circle, right? Yeah.
So this is one reason why this aircraft is so important to me, because Captain Nick, our very close friend and one of the organizers of this event, has a near and dear relationship with it, and he can tell you much more about it. And our good friend Marcus from the Omega Tau podcast interviewed him about flying the F-18 and also the F-4, which was the predecessor to that, and so it's very wonderful to be so close to it.
One of the other things that's different about the Hornet and Super Hornet is the size. The Super Hornet, I can't remember in feet how much larger it is, but it's significantly larger. So if they were side by side, you would definitely know that they were two different aircraft.
So, David, how did they do on the F-A-18?
They were fine.
Good. All right.
Well, I was going to say, we'll be going on in a little bit after we interview the pilot of that particular aircraft, but we'll be going on to make some bigger mistakes later, I'm sure.
Okay.
And Micah, F-16s were for a while designated F-A-16s.
Really?
Just so you know.
So why were they undesignated F-A?
Because the Pentagon / Air Force decided that they didn't really need the second designation. But the majority of an F-16 role now is air-to-ground, not air-to-air. The only real aircraft that really meets a F designation anymore is the F-15C. That is an air-to-air, no air-to-ground capability. That's why we have Strike Eagles. The Navy, for some reason, kept a designation, and believe it or not, for a while there, we had the FA-22 also.
That's right. I do recall that. And now it's just the F-22. All right. Up next, we have an interview with one of the pilots.
Yes, we were standing there, and as we were going, talking about the aircraft a little bit, the pilot was there, and the naval representative went up to him, asked if he would talk to us, and it was Lieutenant Jeff Hoagie Hanley, who was a pilot of that aircraft, and did some demonstrations on it. So the next interview is the four of us talking with Lieutenant Hanley. We're here speaking with Lieutenant Jeff Hoagie Hanley from the U.S. Navy, who flies this beautiful F-A-18. You've been flying it for some time now, haven't you?
About 4 or 5 years.
What do you like about it?
It's just an airplane that can do so many different missions and so many different things, that the variety of training and opportunities that we have flying this airplane just make it an absolute blast. And also, this airplane just does what you want it to do. It's fantastic.
Now, one of the things about this aircraft, it's used by a number of different nations, and our friend flew the FA-18 for the Royal Air Force, but you are a naval aviator. That's a completely different thing. You're not a pilot, you're an aviator, so you have to trap. Can you tell us a little bit about what a trap is and what that means and how you come down on a carrier?
Well, landing on the aircraft carrier is essentially taking a trap, is another term for it. So basically taking 44,000-ish pounds of steel and bringing it to a stop in about 200 feet of cable draw out there in about 2 or 3 seconds. So it's about 150-0. So it's pretty fun landing on the ship. I mean, it is what makes us naval aviators, just like you said. And it's the amount of training that we get to the point where you can do it. is essentially it's what it takes. It takes lots and lots and lots of practice, lots of training.
And what's important for our audience to know is it's not just a short runway where you're laying down a hook to trap a cable to get caught on that, but it's also a runway that you're not necessarily sure where it's going to be, and it's rolling from side to side and up and down all at the same time. So naval aviators are truly amazing pilots, and I'm not sure how well our audience knows that, and they need to know that, and our good friend Matt needs to know that too. A naval aviator is completely different from an Air Force pilot. Now, you do this day or night, any weather. How long does it take to learn to catch a line?
Well, you spend about a year in Kingsville Meridian, basically a Texas or Mississippi, doing it in a modified Hawk, a Goshawk, a T-45. You do hundreds and hundreds of practice landings in the field, and on the airfield and the runway, they have a painted carrier box with the appropriate, you know, instrumentation to kind of show you exactly what it would look like. So the first time you roll into the groove on a carrier, it looks very, very familiar, and you're going to have lots of practice. The muscle memory is all going to be there. And after you do that, you get qualified in that airplane, and then you'll get qualified in this airplane after you go through a full tactical syllabus. So it takes a while. It takes a couple of years, lots of practice landings. LSO, the paddles are going to help you out. The guys that are on the ground or on the ship helping you get on deck, they're going to give you lots of sugar and give you some love to get you on deck the first time. It's definitely happy to have they call them angels in white, the guys in the white coats out there helping you out.
Are you getting any special training or program set up to transition to the F-35, or are you going to be with the FA-18 for the rest of your career?
I have no idea where the rest of the career is going to go. It's really just a matter of how quickly things come on board. The RAG is, or the Fleet Replacement Squadron for the F-35 is obviously stood up down in Eglin, VFA-101. And they're working really hard. They're moving forward very quickly. It's just a matter of when it happens and the timing and where I end up. But the F-18, particularly the Super Hornet, is going to be around for a very long time. So if somebody wants to stay F-18s, hopefully they continue to do that. They want to do that if they want to transition to the F-35. Two very different airplanes. I'm really anxious to see what it's able to do and how it's able to contribute to the carrier strike group and the air wings out there in the real world. I'm really curious to see how it all turns out. But it's exciting times. New airplanes, transitioning to different kind of models of how we're employing these things overall as far as an air wing strike group perspective is concerned.
When you're coming in onto a carrier, at least especially at first, your heart is usually in your mouth and there could be all sorts of things in other places. But I understand that feeling can be a little frightening, especially at first, even though you're well-trained. It's always, you never know what's going to happen. But I understand the takeoff is one of the most thrilling and most amazing experiences that anybody could have, and one that I've always wanted to try. Can you describe what a carrier takeoff is like at an FA-18?
Daytime cat shot doesn't get much better than that. It's about 0 to 150, 170 miles an hour, depending on how heavy you are. It has to get you to a certain end speed. The heavier you are, the faster you got to go. So especially if it's some sort of asymmetrical loadout, it's pretty good little jolt. It's a lot of fun. And the interesting part about it is that when you have your throttles all the way up, your flight controls are all the way up, you're ready to go, you give them the signal that you're ready to go, it's still a solid 4 or 5 seconds before they actually launch you off, and you don't know when it's going to happen. So it's always a little bit of a surprise, which is kind of fun. Nighttime is absolutely terrifying, I will tell you that, especially if there's no moon, no stars, you have no horizon. So you're essentially launching into a milky black abyss, which is definitely a little spooky, but daytime, it can't beat it. It's a lot of fun.
And the pitch and roll must be interesting as well. So just like on landings, you have to pay special attention to that on takeoff as well?
They'll time it. If the deck's pitching up and down, they will time the shot so that we'll launch you off essentially when the deck is all the way up. And they're pretty good about timing that. Absolutely right. It's kind of important, obviously. For the pitch and roll, it's something you get accustomed to. They have different ways of guiding you to the appropriate place to land depending on how much the deck is pitching. I think the worst pitching deck we saw was off like the Azores, in like the open water, essentially the Atlantic Ocean. That's where it gets a little more compared to, in Gulf or sort of littoral regions where it's a little smoother. It can definitely get a little spooky out there.
So a bit about your career. How did your sort of aviation career begin for you?
Well, I started flying Cessnas and Piper Cubs.
Same as me.
And just fell in love with it right away. Always had a lot of interest in aviation, even from like when I was a little kid. But my friends take a lesson in a Cessna and just kind of be in love with it. So I got a little bit of just private pilot type stuff when I was in college. And then I did not do any academy or ROTC. I just off the street graduated college, said I'll go to OCS and roll the dice and see what happens. And I was lucky enough to just be lucky at every wicket to where I ended up exactly where I wanted to be, which is flying a Super Hornet. So you know, naval aviation is all about timing. I got very lucky every time that timing came up. So I'm just fortunate to that they still let me do this, and hopefully they'll let me do it for as long as I can. So.
Do you still have time when you're at home to do a bit of sort of recreational flying?
Oh, sure. Every now and then I flew the wife and I out to, you know, just different locations, you know, if we had the time. Obviously, it's a little expensive for me. I don't do it very often, but every now and then, for instance, my wife's birthday, after we got married, first thing we did was take her up flying, just kind of a birthday present to see how she enjoyed it. She's obviously terrified, but it was because it's different when you actually see the person at the controls, I think. She's growing to like it a lot as well. Just general aviation is a lot of fun. Different world, obviously, what we do out here. Very missionized, obviously. Everything that we do is for a mission reason, but it is nice to just take off and kind of bomb around in a prop plane every now and then. It's a good time. So definitely enjoy it.
It's one of the last questions I was going to ask. We always ask all the pilots who interview for the show, and it's a question that sometimes catches people out. But given the chance to fly any aircraft in the world, either retired or still flying, anything at all, what would be your choice aircraft to have a go in?
Oh, boy, you're opening up so many cans of worms with this, all the community rivalries and all that stuff, so I got to be real careful.
Remember, it doesn't have to be current, okay?
Yeah, that's true. I spent my entire career trying to get in this airplane, and so that has been my goal the entire time since I got into the business. So I think during that time, I would have told you, yeah, I want to get into this airplane, obviously, because I really enjoy it. This airplane allows you to do so many different things. You air-to-air, air-to-ground, everything. You know, landing on the boat, taking off from the boat, it does it all. So I've been very happy to get into this airplane. I think it'd be cool to get into some of, like, the first jet airplanes. I think they're always fascinated by, you know, things like Banshees, stuff like that, the original jets that flew and landed and took off from aircraft carriers. That would be a really neat thing to see, and just how terrifying a straight deck carrier probably was. And I have friends, obviously a fair amount senior to me, that had done some straight deck landings and stuff like that, and it'd be cool to see that. I will never have the chance, but historically, yeah, kind of the first jets that took off and landed from aircraft carriers, I'd like to see that. So,
Lieutenant Hanley, Hoagie, yeah. Thank you very, very much for being
you.
A part of this.
No, of course.
Thank you so much for your service.
Thank you very much.
So,
enjoy
the
guys. So.
And enjoy the rest of Farnborough 2016.
Sure will.
Thank you.
David, when he said straight deck, what was he talking about?
Originally, aircraft carriers were a straight deck, meaning that when you landed, you parked all of the aircraft onto the front of the deck. At the end of World War II, the British came up with something called the through deck or angled deck. If you look at an aircraft carrier from the top, you'll see that the back of the aircraft goes from, so that you are landing on a diagonal in cross from where the ship is going. So you can park the aircraft up front, and if you miss on a angled deck aircraft carrier, you can go around, which is the real reason why it came up, because it was jet aircraft. When a carrier-based aircraft like a Super Hornet lands, just before they hit the deck, they go to full throttle in case the arrestor hook doesn't engage the arrestor cables. Therefore, they can go around. And that's one of those things that the angled deck completely changed carrier aviation. We wouldn't really have carrier aviation if it wasn't for the angled deck and the British coming up with it. The Americans, we took the thing and ran with it, but with our super carriers. But the angled deck gives you the ability to do a bolt or a go around without jeopardizing the other aircraft on the forward deck. It also gives you the opportunity to do, you can launch aircraft as well as recover aircraft simultaneously in cyclical ops. So a lot of times training aircraft carriers, what you'll see is you'll see somebody land on the angled deck and then taxi up to the front of the aircraft carrier and then get their first cat shot. Because believe it or not, the first thing you get when you become a naval aviator is you get your carrier landing. The second thing you get is your cat shot. Because you take off from the land and you land on the carrier and then you get your cat shot. So most people probably think, well, you start from the aircraft carrier and then you land on it. But that's not the way it goes. Your very first landing on an aircraft carrier is what makes you a naval aviator. And then that's followed by your cat shot.
All right. Fascinating. All right, guys. What do we have next from Farnborough?
Sitting next to the F-A-18 was an F-16. So Brian and Matt and Carlos and I walked over there and talked a little bit about the F-16 Fighting Falcon. And here it is.
So we've moved aircraft again. We are now in front of the F-18.
No, we were in front of the FA-18, right. And now we're in front of an F-16.
I noticed from the stickers that are around the actual vehicle that this one's a Viper. Now, what does the Viper actually stand for? What is that?
Well, it's actually known, the F-16 is called the Fighting Falcon. That's a designation from the Air Force, but the pilots and anybody who knows it really well calls it a Viper. And you can see when you look at it, and we'll show some pictures of it later, it looks like a Viper. When you look at where the pilot seat is, the canopy is, sitting over the engine, it looks like it's a Viper ready to strike. And it is just as deadly, if not more deadly. The F-16 is a fighter as opposed to an attack aircraft. It's not an FA aircraft. It's for the Air Force, not Navy, and it's single engine as opposed to twin engine. But it's a real interesting thing about how it developed is the fact that there was a fly-off between the I believe it was the YF-16 and the YF-17. The YF and the F-16 won, and then the U.S. Air Force picked the F-16. But the YF-17 was an incredible bird, an amazing plane, and it was very, very close, side by side. So after they picked the F-16, the Navy looked at the YF-17 and said, maybe we should do something with it. And from the YF-17 came the FA-18. And it's really, there are big differences, but if you were to see the fly-off, you'd say, oh, that's an F-18 flying off against the F-16. Now, the F-16 flies for the Air Force Thunderbirds. The FA-18 flies for the Navy Blue Angels. And they're both amazing aircraft. But I learned this from our good friend David Vanderhoof. I only just learned this recently. The Air Force flies F-16s that could be taken out of the Thunderbirds and go into service at any time, ready to go. All they got to do is load them up with ammunition. But the Navy gets the oldest F-18s flying around. The oldest and the most decrepit, ready to go to the boneyard aircraft, but they keep them flying and flying perfectly. And if anybody sees a demonstration of the Navy F-18 Blue Angels, it's an unbelievable demonstration in aircraft that are ready to be retired.
So I noticed you got the F and the FA. What's the difference between those two letters? What's the significance?
F stands for fighter. And if you'll remember, and you may not know this, you've heard of the P-51 Mustang.
Yes.
P-51, the P-40, the P-38, the P stood for pursuit. They were pursuit aircraft. They were out to go after other aircraft. That was during World War II. After World War II, shortly after with Korea, the designation got changed, and there were some P-51s that got redesignated the F-51 as a fighter aircraft. And there is no longer a P. There's no longer pursuit aircraft. There were also A's for attack aircraft. The A-10, as we talked about before, the A-26 Invader, and those are attack aircraft for ground support. The FA-18 is designed to do both, attack, ground support, as well as air-to-air. It is the only carrier-based fighter, and I don't believe there's any other attack aircraft on the carrier any longer. When they retired the F-14, the one that we saw Tom Cruise fly, okay, it's just FA-18s any longer. And it's designed to be able to perform both missions, where the F-16 is fighter. It's designed to be air-to-air, although it can also do some ground attack. It's just not the perfect ground attack aircraft.
So why should I be really excited about this particular aircraft? Why should I be so excited about the 16 here? What's so special?
The F-16, also a single-engine aircraft, like we said before. The engine that's in there is the same engine as in the F-15, but the F-15 has two of them. Okay, and it was designed like that so that they can switch out engines pretty much as needed. I guess the reason to be excited is because it's fast, it's beautiful, and look at it. Have you ever seen anything that looked deadlier?
Yeah, it was so much fun being with Matt and Carlos doing these segments because Matt, as we said before, really is new to aviation. And just to see someone with these, you know, baby kid eyes just take in all of the information and all the sights and sounds. It was really fun hanging out with them and doing these interviews.
Now, coming up next, we have what? The PBY? So cool.
Yeah, this is both Micah and my, I believe, most favorite aircraft. When we were standing over by the F-16, I saw a guy in a jumpsuit, and he had the PBY patch on his flight suit, and I went over to him and I said, "Hey, you wouldn't happen to be associated with that PBY that I saw land?" He said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I am." So I asked him if we could do an interview, and Mike and I and crew went over to the PBY and got to interview the captain of the PBY.
All right, let's listen.
Okay, we've moved to another part of the airfield now, and I have a Micah who's standing to my left at the moment. He's rather excited about where we're standing right now. So, we are standing in front of...
It's the PBY-5A Catalina, built in 1943. Her name is Miss Pickup, which we'll learn about why a little soon from Captain, in a moment from Captain Rod.
So, tell us a little bit about the aircraft. I mean, what role does it serve at the moment?
I reckon it's actually one of the first multi-role combat aircraft there were during the war, because it's for air sea rescue, long range surveillance, and light attack, because they used to put torpedoes, depth charges, bombs, whatever under the wings. They did sink quite a few U-boats during the war.
Yeah, this is definitely one of my most favorite aircraft, so quite happy to be here and standing next to her.
Okay, and I have to ask the question, why? What is it? Why should I, as the novice here, be so excited about this aircraft?
Yeah, I think really because of its mission during World War II, the air-sea rescue. My grandfather was in the Coast Guard, and just the valuable contribution that it made to the war, and being a spotter, and of course being the search and rescue aircraft. Yeah, really, really contributed a lot.
And the other thing that you need to know about, this is also my favorite aircraft. And it's one of my favorite aircraft. I have many favorite aircraft. But I did a piece for the Airplane Geeks several years ago about a restoration of one taking place in Sanford. And it's one of my favorite aircraft because I call it the DC-3 of the sea. Because the DC-3 could do anything, and it could fly forever. And it had R-1800 engines, the same engines as a PBY-5A does. But the PBY-5A not only did it from the sea. Do you remember how we talked about the difference between an Air Force pilot and a naval aviator? The PBY does everything a DC-3 does, but can do it in water.
Wow. Wow. So this can land on the water, can it?
Yes, we still do when we can. Yeah. Not often enough.
No.
And so let me ask you a little bit about flying the PBY, and a bit about type ratings and what it's like to take off and land in the water with such a huge, I mean, this is a big, big airplane. It's not a little float plane. How did you become a type rated in a PBY, and how long have you been flying her?
I mean, the actual conversion, as long as you're used to flying something else, apart from perhaps the size, which does take a bit of getting used to, then it's a fairly straightforward twin engine conversion from any other source. Even if you're only a single engine pilot, you know, you gradually get a twin rating and all the rest of it, but it's just as well to have a twin rating before you start. But it's quite different from a lot of other aircraft. It will not settle down and fly itself. You have to fly it all the way. You can't take your hands off. There's no autopilot in there. And it waddles around the sky all over the place. So it needs a lot of work to actually fly it. Once you've got the hang of it on the land, then being on the water, that's another steep learning curve. Getting it on the water is... The only advantage you have on water, if you've got a big enough lake, is you're always going to land into wind. That's the whole idea of it, to make it easy. But once you're on the water, it gets even harder, because unlike a float plane, we haven't got any water rudders. There's no brakes on the water.
And the engines are fairly close together as well.
So all we've got is, you know, bootfuls of rudder either way, a lot of power on one side or the other. And if you try taxiing downwind, well, that's almost impossible. You just get a few degrees off and you finish up doing a circle and carrying on again. But, you know, it's a lot to learn. And, you know, it's never ending, really.
I mean, one of the things that I'd heard is that during World War II, when the aircraft would be fully loaded, I mean, and very, very heavy, and taking off from a flat surface, that it might go take up miles of space before you could get her up on into the air. Could you talk about what it's like to take off with all that drag?
Well, I mean, in what we don't really like is a glassy surface, because there's a huge amount of suction on the hull, both when you're landing and trying to take off. because when you're landing, it'll just grab the hull and try to pull you down, which is why you have the little step in the fuselage just behind the wheels there, trying to break up the suction. And similarly, when you're trying on the water, trying to take off, you've got to break the suction to get it off. So we do like at least some disturbance on the water. During the war, they could actually land on extremely heavy seas, going right out the other extreme from a glassy water, but we limited ourselves to about 2-foot waves if we can.
Her name is Miss Pickup, and there's a special reason for that name. Tell us about what kind of air sea rescue the PBY did in World War II.
Because of the air sea rescue capability, then it can pick people up out of the water, so that's why they chose that one, obviously.
The PBY rescued many flyers, because it could, again, do anything. And Matt, what I wanted to say, the other thing, why should you be excited about this plane? Just look at her. She's beautiful. Max Flight once said a DC-3 is the way an airplane ought to look. Well, it's true, but a PBY is what an airplane should look like. It's a gorgeous craft with a beautiful lines, and even if Miss Pickup wasn't on her, I would still love her.
Now, I'm just going to ask the question, as I said, just turn over there. We've got the pods on the back there. What were they for during World War II?
Well, those blisters, as we call them, for obvious reason, are actual modern replacements from the originals.
Yeah.
Obviously, going back during the war, they didn't know how to produce plexiglass things like that, I don't think. No. Anyway, they wouldn't last very long. So they had some heavily framed affairs where the front bit was fixed, the back bit was fixed, and the bit in the middle used to rotate inboard. And just inside there, they had 50 calibre machine guns mounted. So when it was fully open, there's a big field of fire for the guys to man their machine guns. And I mean, it's a very slow aeroplane, so it was very easily attacked in the warp. So, you know, they needed all the weaponry they could get. There used to be a gun turret on the nose as well, just in front of the cockpit. That had a single, double guns, whichever model they happened to be. And there used to be, where our air stair goes up now at the back, there used to be a fixed gun facing backwards as well.
It had a bit of firepower.
And the blister itself, when you look at it, it's right now it's one big bubble, but they would open like an eyelid. You would reach around and open it up, and that's where the 50 calibers would fire from, but also be where we'd pick up from the sea from. And the other interesting thing about those particular blisters is on the original B-17B, I believe, they used the same blisters before they came up with different kinds of turrets in the side. And you would, if you look at that original aircraft, if you ever watch the 1941 film Air Force, where you see that, you'll see those blisters.
Anyway, Rob, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for telling us a little bit about the aircraft.
All right, very exciting. PBYs are so nice looking, as you say, Mike. And I understand that there were quite a number of these things produced, over 3,000, I think, in total.
Yeah, I don't know how many, but there are still quite a few hanging around. And in fact, a few years ago, I think I produced a piece for the Airplane Geeks about one that they're restoring down here, up here in Sanford, Maine, that they are still working on. And I hope to catch a ride in one day if they ever get it in the air again.
Oh, yes, for sure. And you'll have to bring us a report of that adventure.
Or bring us along.
Even better. See, Brian thinks of those things. Yeah, I got to give Brian credit.
Speaking of Brian thinking of things, in order to appreciate this next interview, you really have to understand how it happened. We interviewed the crew of the P-8 that was on display at the air show. But it happened, you see, it was Sunday afternoon. The air show was over. It had just closed down. And Brian and I had head back to the hotel, said goodbye to everybody, and we decided to sit down and finally have an adult beverage and sit and talk and get everything together and plan some things out. So Brian sat down, and I walked up to the bar and ordered our two adult beverages. And standing next to me was a gentleman, and he was slightly ahead of me. And the bartender asked me first if I was ready to order. And I said, no, this gentleman's ahead of me. And so he ordered. And walking up to him was someone in a flight suit I didn't recognize, a uniform I didn't understand, but he had a P-8 patch on it. And I said, oh, the P-8, that's a great aircraft. And he said, yeah, it certainly is. And he and his friends took off and went outside into the garden. I brought my drinks back and sat down with Brian. And Brian said, it's really warm in here. Do you want to sit outside? And I said, sure. So we walked outside and sat down, found a table in the shade, and had a sip of the adult beverages. And I said, oh, look, there's a P-8 crew over there. And Brian looked at me, and I looked at Brian, and I said, okay, what the heck? And we walked over.
The worst they could do was say no. Let's go for one more interview.
So we walked over there and said, gentlemen, I know you're totally off duty and you can absolutely say no to this, but we're from the Airplane Geeks podcast and we'd very, very much like to interview, if you wouldn't mind, and talk a little bit about the P-8. And they said, sure. And here we go.
Hi, Mike and I managed to find some naval aviators here. We've covered the commercial side for a bit, so now we're going to cover some military stuff.
And we're speaking with UK Squadron Leader Mark Folds, Australian Flight Lieutenant Chris Godfrey, and US Naval Aviator Lieutenant Lyle Gerard, who all fly the new P-8. Now, the P-8 is an aircraft that replaced the P-3, but a lot of our listeners don't know what the purpose of the P-3 nor the P-8 was. So could you tell us a little bit about those two aircraft, what they're about, and when the P-8 came into existence and the transform?
Absolutely. So Lieutenant Lyle Gerard here from Patrol Squadron 30 down in Jacksonville, Florida. I flew both P-3s and P-8, which is the Maritime Patrol Reconnaissance Aircrafts. So our primary mission is anti-submarine warfare. With anti-surface warfare and maritime ISR.
And the P-3 was a turboprop. The P-8 is a turbofan. And one of the beauties of the P-3, and when I think about the history of it, it really goes all the way back to the B-29, but it had a longer capability and could fly forever and ever and ever. Talk a little bit about that compared to the P-8. What is the range and extension between the P-3 and the P-8 and difference in the capabilities of the two?
Sure. So I guess from our perspective, the Australian perspective and some of the US Navy and the Brits as well, the aircraft was designed for the outset to go out 1,200 miles, do 4 hours on station and come in 1,200 miles back home, which is an extension over the P-3 capability. It can also get there far more quickly. So commanders can say we need them there. We fly at a higher altitude, so we fly in the mid-30s and we TAS about 25% quicker. So we're a bit more responsive there. Once we get down to low level, the fuel flow is a little bit higher than the P-3 was, but it's still as manoeuvrable. And I think mainly the ability to get somewhere quicker, do your time on station, get home, is probably the biggest advantage over the Orion. And I think automation and the modernness of the design of the airframe, so it's got a flexible wing box, so the wing actually moves a lot more than the Orion's wing did, so crew comfort and fatigue is much reduced over the P-3.
So with a multinational crew being stationed in Jacksonville, how do y'all get along?
Well, we get along fine.
Yeah, the Brits and the Aussies got on pretty well.
Of course.
No, it's good, actually. I'm Squadron Leader Mark Folds. I'm sorry, I'm not a naval aviator. I'm in the Royal Air Force. I've been seconded across to Jacksonville for 4 years. And I'm the flight commander in charge of, loosely in charge of the seed corn project at Jacksonville. And it's been great. We've been very much integrated into the fabric on VP-30, as Lyle says, as the FRS, the Fleet Replacement Squadron, or as us Brits would call it, the OCU, the Operational Conversion Unit. And it's been, we've been totally welcomed. It's been fantastic. Our colleagues, the Australians, turned up about 18 months, 2 years ago now,
yeah,
I guess.
18 months ago, yep.
And that's been great. So it really is multinational.
I'm going to go a step backwards and go into something about the P-8. For those listeners who may not be familiar with what it is a Boeing product, and it's actually based on a 737. And it's a 737 one variation fuselage with a different wing. Can you tell us a little bit about how the P-8 came about in terms of its combination?
Yeah, so it's a completely bespoke airplane. We've had quite a few folks at RIA at Fairford last weekend and this weekend at Farnborough just saying, so I guess it's a converted airliner, but it's not. It's completely brand new, built from the bottom up, and it's a 737-800 fuselage and a 737-900 wing with some added winglets at the end, really for aerodynamic and icing features, but absolutely brand new. The airplane that we flew over here is 2 months old. Pretty much. So it's really nice to get into an airplane. It's not always been the same in my RAF career, having such a brand new airplane. So, and really, it's at the cutting edge of technology. It's really, really quite a platform when you combine the air vehicle and the mission systems.
And what was recently announced, if I remember correctly, within the past couple of months, is that finally the UK has decided to acquire the P-8s. When did that come about and what is it replacing?
So yeah, that happened on the 23rd of November. We had our SDSR, or our Strategic Defence and Security Review. We had one in 2010 as well, which unfortunately led to the demise of the Nimrod Mark II and MRA-4. But now, you know, we're moving on into the future. SDSR 2015, David Cameron stood up in Parliament in the House of Commons and said that they were to purchase 9 airplanes and base them at RAF Lossiemouth up in Scotland. And only Monday, the 11th there, just last Monday, David Cameron came to meet the Seed Corn crew and a few key individuals to basically sign on the dotted line with Defence Secretary Michael Fallon So we're going to buy 9 airplanes, and the purchase is going to start in 2019, so it's really exciting for the UK.
So you're going to be flying, just like new aircraft now, you'll be flying new aircraft for quite some time.
Absolutely, yeah. And I've got, there are 2 pilots and 9 rear crew with me in Jacksonville, so we're going to probably bolster that a little bit by a couple of extra pilots and a few extra rear crews. So looking forward to training crews, Brit crews, in the next couple of years. It's exciting times.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for agreeing to do this very late interview in the afternoon, and it's been marvelous meeting you all, and we know you get up to Maine. That's where I am. I'm known as the Maine man, but Maine with an E.
There you go.
Yeah, and also thank you guys for your service. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome. Great, lovely to meet you.
Yeah. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers. Cheers.
Yeah, I think it was so appropriate ending with a clink of a glass for the interview, but this group of guys were really, really special and went out of their way to be nice, so much so. They actually came back and adopted me for the evening. I believe Micah might have been a little tired and retired for the evening. And we went out and they took me out for drinks around the town and just had a fantastic time with them. It ended up there was about 24 of them that we met with later on in the evening. And again, just had such a special time.
Part of the crew went out with Brian, and part of the crew stayed back at the hotel with me. And at, right at the end, we clinked glasses, and we were ready to say goodbye and let them, you know, be. They were together, you know, and doing these interviews and hanging out with people they needed to hang out with for that whole week. And they said, no, stay with us. And that's what happened.
Now, what is this print that I see that you guys apparently left Farnborough with?
Well, before we left, what had happened actually when we introduced ourselves, at that point we had 1 Airplane Geeks button left. And I said to them, when we introduced ourselves, I said, I need to ask who is the highest ranking officer because I apologize, I can't read Royal Australian or RAF rank. And it was Squadron Leader Mark Falls. And I said, well, then this is yours. You can give it to whomever you want. And then later on that evening, about maybe it was an hour or so after the interview, they had 1 poster left from VP-30, and they took that poster and they passed it around to everybody on the crew and had them all autograph it and said, here, this is for you guys. And I gave it to Brian, and Brian said, that's great, and he put it up in his room, and then turned out he didn't have room in his luggage for it. So I ended up with it and got it framed, and it's now up on my wall, and I figured better put it up here on the Airplane Geeks too.
Well, that's actually the story that I told you. No, Micah, with all of your help in doing all of these interviews, I really big shout out and thank you to you for that. So it really was my intent to give that to you. It was certainly special that they signed them. John Mollison, our Airplane Geeks, I guess, unofficial art historian or artist, he once said that the importance of art is the stories that go along with it. And Micah, you and I definitely have a bunch of stories to go along with that print. It's not the print that's the important part, as great as it is. It's the stories that we have to go along with it. And thank you so much for your help in putting together these interviews, the time that you spent doing it. And most of all, thank you for our friendship. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me along back there. And when was it? February? You said, hey, do you want to go to Farnborough? Who would have thought that? And, you know, the print may be yours one day. You said, put me in a will. Well, I did.
Now, we have a photo of the print, and we'll put that in the show notes so that you all can see that.
And I think we have some other photos, too, of the interviews with the at the F-18 with Lieutenant Hanley and at the Fighting Falcon, and maybe we can put those up as well.
Very good. Thanks, guys, for all your hard work at Farnborough. And, we'll see what happens next year at Paris, maybe, or in 2 years at Farnborough. Of course, we have next year Oshkosh coming up, and we hope to get a good contingent of Airplane Geeks out for that as well. But as far as Farnborough concerns, again, thanks, guys, for all the hard work and the great recordings.
My pleasure.
It was so much fun.
All right, now we're going to move on and take a look at some of the aviation news from the past week. So why don't we get started with that right away? We We have an article from Air Cargo News. This is Atlas backs the B-747 freighter as Boeing considers its future. I think most of us have seen in the news lately some announcements from Boeing and Airbus. Boeing announced a cut in the 747 production rate, and they also stated in a regulatory filing that it may be possible that they'll be ending production of the 747. Then at the same time, we see Airbus plans to cut the production rate of the A380. So there are many, many articles in the press about, is this the death of the, or the impending death of the large wide-body airplane? What do you guys think? Is the end of an era upon us?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I just hope that they don't stop production before they're awarded the final contract and, I guess, ability to go into production of the replacement of Air Force One. That'll be really, really expensive to retool and get that line going again.
I think this announcement came, and they only started talking about the elimination of the 747 after. Wasn't the VC-25 contract already awarded, David?
The contract's not awarded yet, but there's no doubt that that will... Those two airframes will come off the line before the line shuts down.
And I think what's interesting about the cargo equivalent and why Atlas likes it is because it's the only commercial aircraft that is really designed as a cargo aircraft where the nose can actually lift up for direct front-end loading. Right. Everything else is military.
Yeah, Atlas Air, which is really Atlas Worldwide Holdings, they have a fleet of 81 Boeing aircraft, and they use them for freight, but also charter and lease. They have a lot of 747s. They have 37, I think, 747s. They have the -400 models, -8s. But when Atlas talks about backing the 747 freighter in this article, I think what Atlas is saying is it's a great airplane for cargo applications, and they hope or they expect to continue to use them for that. But that doesn't really impact, I don't think, Boeing's decision as to whether or not to increase, decrease, or cut production of the 747 altogether. There are certainly a lot of them out in the desert that I think Atlas could pick up and use as freighters.
Yeah, and I don't think it's the end of large cargo aircraft, as I think someone mentioned. It's the end of four-engine cargo aircraft. And maybe a twin will be designed, we'll be able to have that direct front-end loading at some time or another. But I think that's what they need to – that's what we're looking at, because the A380, the 747 just aren't fuel efficient enough with four engines.
But there's always the Russians. They're restarting the AN-124 Condor line, so
– ah.
There's always the Russians, and who knows, the Chinese might figure out some way of producing 747s or something. So something to think about.
That is interesting. Maybe under license or something, or do you think their own versions of a wide body?
I think eventually they'll make their own version of a wide body. Oversized loads need to be accommodated for. So if you're going to always need something like a 747 or... not an A380 because Airbus is never going to do that. But the AN-124 is a perfectly designed cargo aircraft, and I'm sure Lockheed's kicking themselves that they wish the C-5 was still in production.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about Air Force pilots. And this article is from Press Herald. Air Force Sweden's bonus in facing pilot shortage. The article reports that the United States Air Force needs 700 more fighter pilots by the end of 2016. And they also note that the shortage could grow to be as many as 1,000 within a few years. I think that there are some enticements from the commercial world that tends to draw pilots away from the Air Force. Is that a fair assessment, David?
Oh, absolutely. Nobody wants to spend every 6 months in a combat zone. Besides the money, I think that's the draw, is we've got way too many people flying combat missions away from home and family when they can be flying airlines and be home half of a month instead of gone away for 6 months to a year.
I think there's maybe a difference in the thrill, not to minimize anything, but between flying a fighter and flying a commercial airliner. But you know, as you mentioned, David, it's almost a quality of life kind of an issue, and maybe the Air Force is struggling a little bit with that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a quality of life issue. I mean, if you know you're going to be deployed for 9 months of a year, you know, you can only do that so long. And the Air Force has done a really lousy job of recruiting and providing statements of what the benefits are to fly aircraft. And it's not just jet fighters, you know. We don't have the reserve and the guard anymore where people can fly airliners on the weekend and go tear up the sky in F-16s on the weekends. Those Air National Guard and reserve units don't exist anymore. So we have active duty and small amounts of guard, and those cutbacks have lessened opportunities and lessened the ability for pilots to really have any motivation to stay in the Air Force. So it's kind of depressing overall.
Yeah, David, doesn't this apply to all branches of service as well?
Well, absolutely. But the Navy has issues also, and Marines as well. But the Air Force, they're primarily pilots. So, I mean, it's an across the board. We've cut back so much. There's less opportunities. You know, you've got either move up or move out, which my father and I had a long conversation about when we had our weekly lunch. You know, and there's a lot of people who they're not going to get the next level, and they just leave to go off and find a job in the airlines.
And the article also talked about drone pilots, and the same thing. They did not separate the difference, from what I read in it, between drone pilots and what would you call it, regular pilots? I'm not sure how to describe it, but they were going to be shortages in both, and they were looking to sweeten the pot for both sets of pilots because they need to keep them there.
We also saw JetBlue in the news. This is from CNN. JetBlue turbulence puts 24 in hospital. Now, this was a JetBlue Airbus 320. It was flying from Boston to Sacramento, and they encountered some rough turbulence, had to divert to Rapid City, South Dakota. It looks like 22 passengers, two crew members were taken to a hospital for evaluation. Some of the news reports, the comments from some of the passengers are pretty spectacular. They talk about flying out of their seats, even hitting the ceiling. Turbulence in flight, of course, is something that could happen almost at any time. I don't know if this was clear air turbulence in this case, or if this was turbulence associated with a thunderstorm or something of that sort. But I guess people without seatbelts on got bounced around quite a bit.
Yeah, it's real important to keep it on.
Yeah, the article did say that it was not clear air turbulence, that the pilot had put on the fasten seatbelt sign, but that and it even said that some people had their seatbelts fastened, but probably not tight enough. But I think what passengers sometimes forget is that Newton's first law of motion applies everywhere.
Even up in the sky, right?
Exactly.
Turbulence is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, Max Trescott, when it comes to detecting impending turbulence, a pilot can get that information from a couple of different sources, right?
Sure. Probably not all of it can be predicted, but a lot of it can. The aviationweather.gov website has added some, what initially were some experimental weather products, and now they're actually rolled out into full production. On a turbulence forecast, and you can actually dial in what altitude you're going to be, what time of day, and actually get a forecast of whether it's going to be light, moderate, or severe. And I can just tell you from personal experience, I've encountered severe turbulence four times in my career. And boy, I remember every instance like it was yesterday, exactly where it happened. You know, and some of those times, for example, the most recent one, ATC had given me a heads up, and I should have slowed down more, but we were going across the country, had a great tailwind, and thought, hey, let's keep going, and that turned out to be the wrong decision. Fortunately, we had an excellent autopilot in the Cirrus, which helped a lot, because I was down there, hiding by the rudder pedals, so I was glad somebody was flying the airplane.
So did you take your seatbelt off while you were hiding by the rudder pedals?
No. You know, the funny thing is I scooched down low in my seat after slamming the throttle to zero. And the owner who was with me told me later, he said, I kept looking at you to see if you're going to be reaching for the parachute handle.
Why would you throttle down to zero? Just curious.
Well, because you know, turbulence is a lot less of a deal when you're slower. So I wanted to get as slow as quickly as possible, and the autopilot was going to keep us reasonably level.
There's an interesting point made in this article that even though when you encounter turbulence of the sort, pretty significant turbulence, it can feel like you're dropping hundreds of feet or something. But in most cases, they say that the drop is only 40 or 50 feet. And this from a former U.S. Airways pilot who's got a safety consulting firm in this case, who says in rare cases planes fall 200 feet or more. But usually it's only that 40 or 50 feet. And the airplane really isn't in any significant danger of crashing or losing control with this kind of air turbulence. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that it definitely feels a lot worse than what it really is.
Yeah, and the worst impact is on passengers that don't have seatbelts on, but the plane itself usually rides through it just fine without any damage.
Yeah, wear your seatbelts. I did see a Condé Nast Traveler article from February earlier this year. In that article, they say that the FAA says that about 58 flyers are injured by turbulence each year. Two-thirds of that number are flight attendants, right? They're not wearing seatbelts, possibly, or passengers not wearing seatbelts when that hits. So, you know, word to the wise. I mean, that's what I do. Whenever I'm on an airliner, any time I'm not up to do something specific, and when I'm in my seat, man, I keep that lap belt tight.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, here's a confession. I don't keep it tight, but I keep it on. My view is I might be subject to some severe turbulence at some point in my flying career. Having it on loose is certainly better than not having it on at all. And it's just right. A little bit more comfortable that way, but absolutely have it on.
Well, speaking about planes dropping, there was an interesting article. This came to us from Ken in our Slack listener team. This is from petapixel.com, which is a photography site, actually. And at first you'll wonder why a photography site is reporting this. But here's the title of the article, Military Plane Plunged 4,400 Feet. Okay, get ready. When pilot's Nikon got stuck in the controls. Oh, this was, oops. This was a Royal Air Force flight. Apparently, the pilot is actually facing a court-martial as a result of this, but his Nikon got stuck in the controls. This was a Voyager transport plane. There's 198 soldiers aboard, and the 4,400-foot drop took place in 27 seconds. I think the crew, I think the folks in the cabin went weightless because of this drop. What's a Voyager? This is a transport plane?
It's based on an Airbus A330, which is why it had side stick controls and the co-pilot or the first officer could not react to it, because with the side stick controls, when one pilot does one thing, the other pilot does the other thing. It does something else. It takes the average of it when the Airbuses, and that's why there was that much of a problem, because it couldn't be overcome.
Yeah, that Boeing design doesn't seem so bad after all, now, does it?
Well, this pilot's in a lot of trouble, it seems.
And you know what? Part of the trouble, it's so often the case that you don't get in trouble for doing something; it's for the cover up afterwards. So he's being charged with perjury, making a false record. So it's like, wow, people just never learn. Everybody makes mistakes. You ought to come clean. You only make it worse when you try and cover it up.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of covering it up, this ought to be in Binet's, you know, strange but true aviation stories category. This is from theaviationist.com. Great site. Great site. You got to check it out if you're at all interested in especially military aviation. Title of this is F-22 Raptor Grounded by Swarm of Almost 20,000 Bees. And actually, Drone Mama found this and passed it along. This occurred in June at the 192nd Fighter Wing Aircraft Maintainers. They found a swarm of bees during a check at Joint Base Langley-Eustis in Virginia. And if you've never seen one of these honeybee swarms, I think it's as they're moving from one location to another, they'll alight on some kind of an object. And what you have is this gigantic gob of bees. And so they decided that the exhaust nozzle on an F-22 looked like a good place to take a little rest. And, you know, there they stuck.
Well, the queen took a rest.
That's right. Everybody follows the queen. Is that how it works, David?
Everybody followed the queen. And basically, the queen alighted on the tailplane of an F-22 and all of her minions followed. So what you get is a glob of bees, which is really kind of impressive. Lots of comments were posted about this when I posted this to our website about things like, must have been the Super Hornet squadrons that put the queen bee there, or, you know, suddenly we now have a new variant for the F-22, the F-22B instead of A.
That's good.
And it seems ironic to me that Drone Mama would have found this.
I know. She keeps her eyes out for these sorts of weird things.
I mean the drone part.
Okay. Man, sometimes, Micah, your humor is just too subtle for me.
Or just not very good.
No, I'm just a little slow in the uptake, I think. But
hey, you know, the key thing we learned out of this was how much a bee weighs. Did you see that?
Not much, right?
Yeah. They vacuum all the bees up, found that they had 8 pounds of biomass, and that translates to 20,000 bees.
Oh, that's how they calculated the number.
Yeah.
Ah, clever. All right. Well, I guess one solution would have been to light the engines, but that would have had a drastic effect on the bees.
That would have been a real honey of a problem.
Yeah, for sure. And probably anybody anywhere near it would have had to scatter quickly for the to avoid the anger of the remaining bees. But
Max, don't you know that an F-22 has polycarbonate fiber honeycomb tailplanes?
Oh, you guys are just—you guys are on fire tonight, I tell you. All right, I see one more item in here. JFK Airport evacuated after false gunfire reports. Is this a breaking news item?
Well, it happened last night.
That's close enough. All right, from last night's news, take it away, Micah.
Well, somebody reported gunfire in JFK, and so they evacuated. I think it was Terminal T8. Can't remember exactly. I don't have the article open in front of me.
Wait, it's New York. What's news about gunfire?
Well, it's strange to have it in the airport, and they also evacuated some people out onto the tarmac, which isn't the best place to evacuate it. But here's the breaking news part. Reported today, there was no gunfire. It was a celebration of an Olympic event. And in one of the bars, some people slammed down their glasses. And because people don't know what gunfire sounds like any longer, they reported gunfire and they had the evacuation. Just craziness.
Oh, I hadn't heard the source of the noises that were interpreted as gunfire. That's kind of hysterical. Think of the disruption, though, that caused when you've got to evacuate a terminal, disrupt the travel of, well, I guess, you know, it's better to be on the safe side with these sorts of things, but a false report of gunfire is going to have an enormous impact.
Yeah, better safe than shot.
All right, let's talk about, what's up with the geeks. And let's see, Max West, let's start with you. Anything exciting in the recent past?
Oh, sure. Just a couple of days ago, everybody knows that when people get their private pilot's license, they'll kind of swap stories about, oh, how many hours did it take you? And, oh, how many hours did it take you? Well, I'm always proud to announce, how quickly my people can complete their check rides. So I sent a guy to his check ride. He passed, and he only had 3,000 hours. So
3,000 hours?
Wow.
3,000 hours, absolutely. Wow. So it turns out it's Airplane Geek's listener, Srinan, an airline pilot from Singapore.
Oh, yes, of course.
Sriman wanted to have his FAA license. So we went through the preparation for him, sent him off the check ride, and now he's not only licensed as an ATP airline pilot who's currently flying the 787 out of Asia, but he now has an FAA private. He's working on getting his FAA CFI because he wants to be able to teach people in his spare time in N-registered aircraft. So got to have a U.S. license to teach in those.
So did Sriman come to the States to visit you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He spent almost 2 weeks here in San Francisco.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that is. Singapore is such a wonderful place. I used to have, I used to travel there on business quite a bit, and I had some great experiences. Met some wonderful people in Singapore. It's just a fantastic place. Very cool. All right.
I was going to say, I should be there in October. Maybe we could get together and do a little meetup.
Great idea.
Congratulations to Sriman, and good job, Max West.
Very good. All right, Brian, you just reached a milestone, I think.
Yeah, my most recent trip to Florida enabled me to cross that 100,000-mile mark. So I unfortunately do not have my 1K status with United because I haven't met the revenue requirement. So, I can't remember his name, but I guess a guest from 2 weeks ago, we were talking about doing mileage runs and revenue runs and status runs. And Kyle, yeah, there you go. Sorry. I've been traveling so much, I don't know what day it is. Yeah, so I'm short on revenue, but I have all my miles done. So in the next, probably month and a half, I'll get the revenue done and woohoo, going for another 175,000 miles.
Yay. All right.
I'm always short on revenue, but that's something else.
That's different. Anything else going on up in Maine? Micah?
Well, one of the things that I've always loved about going to different FBOs is that there's typically a little cafe there. And I was always upset that up here in Portland, at PWM, there really isn't a cafe at the FBO. Except that this week I found out that the hotel across the street from the FBO does have a great little cafe in it. Now, there's no view or anything, but there's some terrific food at some great prices. And it's just nice to be able to know. And when I go out there plane spotting and I want to stop and have a bite, there's a little cafe available to me right there by PWM.
I love airport diners and, cafes and FBOs, things like that. It's always an exciting place to go to, run into people that you don't know that turn out to be very interesting. All right. Well, if you haven't figured out, I saved the best for last. David Vanderhoof, have you done anything exciting in the last, 24 hours?
As we record this afternoon, I went flying for the first time in 2 years, and I was honored to be taken up by the Geico Skytypers. This is my third flight with them. My second actually in a Geico Skytyper. The last time I was in another aircraft filming them, but I got a call at 9:45 this morning, and I was at Atlantic City's flight line by 11:45. And by 1:00, I was in an airplane flying the coast off of Atlantic City in the back of an SNJ-2 for the first time in 2 years. My butt hurts. My back hurts because I was wearing a parachute. But it was an amazing flight. The cockpit was open the whole time. Brenda and the team at Geico, who I've grown to adore, and Jim, who took me up today, we had fun. It was a three ship. I'll try to get some video uploaded. We actually had a GoPro aimed at my face as I videotaped the flight.
Does that show a great big smile on that face of yours, David?
Oh, yeah. It's just awesome. I'm so thankful for my friends at the Skytypers, and the fact that they gave me an opportunity to go flying with them is just awesome. And Jim isn't a pilot. And, we did things in this flight that I've never done before. We were doing high-speed banks, and we came over Atlantic City Airport, and the boss called brake, and we all did high-speed brakes, pitch up and brakes into rolls into a carrier, almost a carrier landing nonstop. It was awesome. It's flying in the back of a World War II SNJ-2, which are some of the oldest SNJs in the world. with an open cockpit on a beautiful, sunny day over the Atlantic Ocean. It was so clear. At one point, our three ship, I looked down and I could videotape our shadows over the white caps over the ocean. It was just awesome. And another point, we were flying into our own smoke. And as I was returning back to base, I looked over the Atlantic and there was all new clouds because of us puffing smoke in the SNJs. So it was an awesome flight. I apologize for no history segment, but you'll have to forgive me. Sometimes it's better to just
go fly. Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Another great event.
Yeah, see, David just keeps doing these great things. I don't know what's the matter with the rest of
us. Brian, no offense, but having beers with a bunch of PA crew is a really good thing. You just need to realize that.
No, it was. Now, had they taken me up in the P8, that would have been really cool.
Well, yeah.
But drinking with them all night long, yeah, that wasn't too shabby either.
No, great experience. All right, we have some feedback from listeners. Be able to get to a little bit of it, not as much as we'd like to, but we do have a recording that our friend Launchpad Marzari sent us. He's commenting on episode 410, and he's talking about Paris versus Air Venture. So let's listen to Launchpad Marzari.
I want to take exception to the comments made by your guest, Mr. Patrick Smith, on episode 410, that America needs a Paris Air Show-like event. Before I begin, let me state a few things for the record. I waited to respond until after I returned from this year's Air Venture in Oshkosh to research my position. This was my fifth Air Venture. I have attended every Paris Air Show since 1991. The U.S. does not need a Paris Air Show. The Paris Air Show has been in decline for many years, to the point I would not recommend going. It has devolved into an aircraft parts manufacturing supply chain expo. Machine tools, fasteners, raw tungsten, titanium suppliers, O-ring manufacturers, seat rail manufacturers, raw carbon fiber, and so on. There was nothing for the owner, operator, or pilot there. The major support companies, Garmin, Bendix King, Jeppesen, Lightspeed, Dave Clark, etc., no longer bother to attend. Consumer GA aircraft with propellers are not to be found. Light jets? Yes. Props? No. The only consumer GA aircraft with a propeller was Cirrus, which only came as a contractual obligation to the French Air Force, with which they have a training contract. Speaking of training, the three major training centers brought no literature for individual flight training, but were only interested in corporate accounts. Think Emirates, Singapore, or Air Berlin. There was no learn to fly or career in aviation display. For enthusiasts, the aerial displays are okay. Boeing's demo of the 787 was fantastic. Wow, can that plane fly? The Dassault Rafale and the Mirage were cool to watch flying, but after that, it got a little thin. Speaking of enthusiasts, all the aircraft are behind fences or corrals. The closest you can get is about 10 feet. Most of the major booths have signs reading invitations only. So look, but look from over there, please. The vendors are on one side of the fence, you're on the other. Now, go to Air Venture. Ask anyone about Air Venture. Ask about access to aircraft, training vendors, on-field classes, stuff to support the owner, the operator, items for the pilot. Ask about careers in aviation and inspiring and recruiting the next generation of aviators. In addition, there is NBAA for corporate GA and Hilo Expo for rotor wing, both of which are underrepresented at Oshkosh. No, America doesn't need a Boeing, Airbus, Lockheed, Dassault supply chain expo. Go to Air Venture, it's bigger, or Sun and Fun, or AOPA's fly-in, or your local air show. They're better. As evidence, please review the photos in the show notes from the Paris Air Show and this year's Air Venture. There is one cool reason to go to the Paris Air Show at Marbeau. During the air show, you can walk out on the taxiway and stand next to a brass plaque that marks the exact spot where Lindbergh landed. That's cool. This is Airplane Geeks listener Launchpad Marzari asking the Airplane Geeks to keep producing fine episodes like 410. Frequency change approved. Good day.
I think that was awesome.
Was that? I love the music and all. That was terrific. So, Launchpad sent these two photos along. Now, I don't know who's got the copyright on these photos, but one is of Oshkosh, and you see the planes. Is that, what do you call it, square there?
Yeah, it used to call me Aeroshell Square. I don't
right,
know
right.
who's sponsoring it now.
Okay, well, it's that square, right, in that photo?
Yes, absolutely.
And so what you see is planes all over this area, and this is an aerial shot, and then there are like little specks that are the people that are all mixed in and around the aircraft. And then in the picture of Farnborough, it's also an aerial shot, and you see all the planes around, but there are barriers around the aircraft, and so the people can only get so close, kind of illustrating the distinction that Launchpad made between the two shows.
I think there's a difference between the shows, though, that it's not saying that we shouldn't have both here. The Paris Air Show and then the Farnborough Air Show, because they alternate, those are commercial air shows for commercial interest, and it's really the general
public.
The general public is invited, but it's not designed as a general public air show.
Right.
It's a sales show.
It's a trade show.
It's a trade show, whereas the Oshkosh is a general aviation event. It's
right.
designed
it's not
for
a trade
the public.
Show.
Yeah, it's not a trade show at all. It's a completely different thing. It's more of a it's bread and circuses, which are fun, but it's a different thing.
No, it's a general aviation trade show. Yeah. If Mike, you haven't been yet, you need to understand that there are thousands of hours that you could spend doing all of the trade stuff at Oshkosh. It's as big of a trade show as Paris or Farnborough.
But major airframers are not at Oshkosh in order to meet with their clients.
Nowadays, I wouldn't say that. There's a reason why there was Boeing and Airbus there every time. I mean, Airbus shows up, and Boeing, well, this year had a monopoly on it because of their 100th anniversary.
Yeah,
But Airbus showed up with an Airbus airframe that was built in the United States via Alaska Air. So don't tell me that they weren't trying to make
Boeing,
trade show out of it.
Well, Boeing might be a special case, again, because of their 100th. But was IAI there pitching, you know, unmanned military aircraft and systems, things like that?
I bet you in 5 years they will be.
Well, because if it gets to that level, then Oshkosh becomes like a Paris or a Farnborough or a Dubai or a Singapore. So I don't know. I guess it's interesting to contemplate putting on an air show is an enormous undertaking for the organizers, but also for the corporate participants. I mean, it's really easy to spend $1 million or more just having a corporate presence at something like a Paris or a Farnborough. You can only have so many of them, I think, around the world, and people can only spend so much corporate dollars supporting that. So it's kind of hard to contemplate another show. I won't say an air show. Another show as big as those others we've been talking about.
Farnborough and Paris have history, but
yes.
So does Oshkosh.
Sure.
And Oshkosh is... And this is me, the military history jerk, calling out the other two air shows that they don't look to expand to general aviation. They don't look to expand to reaching out to the general public. You know, Oshkosh is become so big because it was reaching out to everybody. There's some, but something for, and Max Trescott backed me up on this. There's something for everyone at Oshkosh. Would you agree?
Absolutely. But you're speaking to the choir here.
Yeah, except for if you're looking to buy seats to put in your A350, yeah, it's not the place to be. You need to be at Paris or Farnborough for that, or I guess now Dubai and Singapore as well, right?
Sure. Yeah, it just seems like apples and oranges to me little bit. And
They're different.
Yeah, they're different, but
they both taste great, right?
taste great, less filling,
and good for you.
Yeah, they're both fruit.
All right. Hey, let's talk about next week just really quickly. We have scheduled to be our guest next week, Jason Blair, Ask the Examiner. Max T., you want to tell us a little bit about what we might hope for next week?
Sure. The reason we decided to bring Jason on is that back in June, the ACS was rolled out, which is the new version of the old PTS at CheckRite. And we've been hearing things from listeners and other folks about how the new ACS is different. And we were just kind of curious if you, the listener, have had a CheckRite since June 15th on the new ACS. And if you did, tell us about your experience. Did you pass? Did you not pass? If you didn't pass, what tripped you up? Or if you have a CheckRite coming up, what would you like to ask the examiner? So go ahead and send an email to us, and we will put those questions to Jason Blair next week. And go ahead, Max. I don't have the email address right here. It would be what?
TheGeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And so this is for the next episode. This is for episode 415. So you've only got a week. I know many of you will not be listening to this until after we record the next episode. So this is a call for those of you who listen to the show pretty quickly after it gets published. So we look forward to hearing from you. Now, we have a few other listener recordings that we've gotten that we've been trying to get to that we haven't yet. One of them is actually from Jason Blair. And I don't know if it's the same Jason Blair or not. Max T., any idea?
Boy, you know what? I didn't notice that in the show notes, but I'll tell you after we hear it. I can.
This is a book recommendation. So let's listen to, this Jason Blair, then we'll decide if it's the same as our guest for next week.
All right.
This is kind of embarrassing, isn't it?
Hello, guys. First, let me say thanks for all the great shows over the years and all the great information you've shared with all the listeners. While Max and Rob and I have met in person, I feel like I also know the rest of you. You do a fantastic job of making all of us out here in listener land feel like part of the family. You may not know it, but you've been with me as I've driven back and forth to do practical tests, while in the air as I listen on cross-country flights, and even while snowshoeing in the winter when the weather was too lousy here in Michigan to actually go flying. Since you've shared so much with me, I wanted to share something back with you and the listeners. I recently had an opportunity to read a book called Finding Carla. It was released by ASA Publications earlier this year. No, I'm not paid by ASA in any way to promote this. In fact, they have no idea that I'm sending this to you to recommend the book. I will, however, admit that I know many of the folks at ASA and have always been impressed not only with their professionalism, but also their dedication not only to aviation training products, but also aviation as a whole. But I digress. Sometimes aviation history isn't about the aircraft, but instead the technology advancements inside them that make the aircraft more effective, more efficient, and our operation of them safer. As the industry is currently working toward rewriting some of the certification processes for light GA aircraft and considering more easily allowing certificated aircraft to install non-certificated instruments to increase safety and capability, this book is an interesting look back at what caused the implementation of the requirement to install a then-new technology that we now consider a standard and have even improved upon to include GPS capabilities for more precise locating, the emergency locator transmitter. The accident in this book is a heartbreaking one in many ways that leaves you in the position that knowing with an ELT, I have no doubt the victims would have been found. But then again, that's part of the reason that this was such a clear case for the motivation to change our flying equipment requirements. This book details how the ELT really got forced into use by general aviation. It's pretty tough to listen to and read parts of the book, knowing that the survivors lasted a long time and would have been found without the ELT. It's a great book to check out. So geeks, if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, take a look back through this book and let's all think forward to what technologies we might have right in front of our industry now that one day we may all question how we ever flew without. Perhaps we might find another one that would make us all safer in the future.
So that is Jason, our guest for next episode, isn't it, Max D?
Yes, it is. And it's been, a week or two. I remember the original email when he sent this.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to it before he came to us next week. All right. Thanks, Jason, for that. Really appreciate it. We love book reviews. If you've read something that's aviation related, like to send us something about the book, a brief review in audio, please do that. We'd love to hear from you. We heard from listener Charlie. Charlie writes this. He says, on a recent podcast, David says that Rolls-Royce produces the F-135 engine for British F-35Bs. Charlie says this is not correct. They produce the lift fan system components manufactured in both the UK and the US. However, they do not build F-135 engines. That's the F-135 is the engine in the F-35. They don't always correspond so nicely, but in this case they do. He says, however, they do not build F-135 engines, which are manufactured by Pratt & Whitney in the U.S. Rolls-Royce has secured the propulsion sustainment contract for UK F-35Bs, so maybe that's what he was thinking. And that's from Charlie in Annapolis, Maryland, another one of my favorite towns in the U.S., a great place to visit, beautiful place. So thanks for that, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie. I sit corrected.
Max, what is a propulsion sustainment contract?
I imagine that that's a maintenance program.
Okay.
But I'm not exactly familiar with it, but that's probably what it is.
It's the maintenance program that Rolls-Royce will be maintaining all of the F-35B engines in the UK.
Engine maintenance is, and aircraft maintenance as well. That's a whole big subject that we really ought to dive into some days, because the way engines, components, airframes, and so forth are maintained can come in a lot of different flavors. Some companies specialize in that. Some operators roll their own. It's a fascinating area. We need to get more deeply into that sometime. I think we'll try to do that. But we heard from Nick. Nick said, firstly, I want to once again thank you for producing an amazing podcast. I look forward to each episode. Thanks, Nick. The reason I'm writing you is to also thank you for your recent episode where you had Matt Johnson on as your guest. Listeners will remember that you interviewed Matt about the university he founded and is the president of, and that's California Aeronautical University. That was back in episode 407 that we talked with Matt. But Nick says, well, I'm proud to let you know that beginning in October, I will be attending California Aeronautical University and will be pursuing their professional pilot program. It's all thanks to you guys. I probably wouldn't have heard of CAU this early had it not been for that interview. He says, I'll be sure to keep you posted of my progress as time goes on. So thanks, Nick. Yeah, it was kind of cool. We were able to facilitate that connection.
At least one. Yeah. Matt invited me to the upcoming air show in Camarillo. And unfortunately, I'm going to be attending my brother's retirement ceremony from the Navy. So I'm going to miss that. Oh. So, yeah, so kind of good news, bad news there. I get to see my brother retire, but I'm going to miss out on an air show.
Yeah. All right. Well, family first. Let's see. We heard from Glenn from New Zealand. He says, I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed Oshkosh this year. And of course, always great to see my friend Rob, that being Rob Mark, of course. Glenn says, this was my fifth year in a row at Oshkosh. It just gets better every year. Last year was pretty amazing, and this one was even better, seeing the amazing Martin Mars, and of course, lots of other great aircraft, including the C-5 Galaxy. And of course, seeing all my friends at Camp Bacon and making new ones, and seeing friends who I know from podcasts like the Airline Pilot Guy and the Uncontrolled Airspace podcast. I did manage to appear on the UCAP episode Foxtrot. Meeting Rob and David at my first Oshkosh really got me interested in podcasts, and now I listen to a lot of them. He says, now the PAXX part, the passenger experience. I totally agree with Kyle Stewart on you get what you pay for. I flew with Air New Zealand from Auckland to Houston this year and used my air points to get an upgrade to a preferred seat on one of their 747, on one of their
777-200ER.
That's what I'm trying to say. And I'm glad I did. Thanks, David. The extra 2 inches of leg room and priority boarding only cost me $80 New Zealand and was worth it. He says, my flight to Chicago from Houston was with Spirit, but I paid extra in advance for the big seat at the front and for my checked bags, and it was still cheaper than Economy Plus with United. The seat was fantastic with so much leg room and wide, too, like a big armchair. I used to be the guy who would never pay for upgrade, but now I think it's totally worth it. Glenn says, keep up the great work, guys. Hope to see you all next year at Oshkosh. So that's Glenn from New Zealand. And yeah, that was one of the big points that our guest Kyle Stewart made, is that, don't suffer. Decide what's important for you and pay for that. Pay for that service. If it's seats, if it's seat pitch, if it's lounges, if it's whatever it is, pay for what you want and don't be miserable accepting just what you get.
And it really makes a difference improving your flight experience.
We heard from Jody Bromer, our good friend Jody Bromer, helicopter pilot. She sent along a link. A UK fraud probe casts shadow over Airbus jet sales. This is from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. They say in there, this is a quote, Britain said it would examine suspected irregularities in the use of third-party agents to win contracts. Airbus said, quote, it has been notified that the UK's Serious Fraud Office, or SFO, had opened a formal criminal probe after being alerted by the country's export credit agency to discrepancies related to the disclosure of the work of local agents. This is a real issue. Sort of the core of it, I think, is that business culture in different parts of the world is different. In some places, you just need to have a local agent in order to do any business. In other places, you need a sales representative, typically someone who's local, but not necessarily. Sometimes there are professional sales representatives that represent your interests in front of your customer, your potential customer. And, of course, these people work for a fee. Usually it's a percentage of sales. Often it's a percentage of sales. The trick is that you need to be very careful that this sales representative is not operating in a business climate that expects bribes and that your fees to the agent aren't really, in fact, being passed along as bribes to the customer. So obviously we don't know at this point if Airbus has been caught up in that sort of thing or not, but this is something that's a big potential issue for aviation-related companies that operate internationally. So I think we'll be watching this.
Well, in full disclosure, Airbus did ply Brian and I with food and drink and all sorts of beverages and nice treatment, but we did not buy any Airbus products for the airplane.
Okay, good. We're safe anyway.
Should I dovetail that with our current? I've taken to adding surveys or on our Twitter account. Right now, there's a current survey, which is simply put, at Boeing or at Airbus. And it'll be running for the next 5 days.
Ah, and so this is under your Twitter name?
No, actually, it's under Airplane Geeks Twitter, at Airplane Geeks.
Okay, I'm a little behind, apparently.
Hey, speaking of keeping up with the latest stuff, have you been on Facebook in the last 5 hours and looked at the David M. Vanderhoff account?
No. What did we find there?
You got to check out the new temporary profile picture. He's there in his Skytypers red, white, and blue helmet, which looks awesome, complete with, what is that, a pull-down visor, David? I'm looking at that.
Yeah, I didn't pull down the visor. I had my sunglasses on because I can't see without them. But it was great. It was a really good. It was a really good day, you know. And I have the other part about it was there was a GoPro in the cockpit that videotaped me for the whole flight. So I've got a lot of video editing to do.
Well, you look good, sir. Thanks for posting the photo.
Have to take a look at that. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. That has links to us on social media, as well as a donate button if you'd like to help support the show financially. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/414. You can subscribe to this podcast through iTunes or Google Play or your favorite iOS or Android podcast app. If you prefer, and I know that we have a few folks that that love email over other means of communication. So if you like, we can set you up to receive an email when each episode comes out. And in fact, it's got a player right in the email, so you can listen to us that way if you like. Visit airplanegeeks.com/archive if you'd like to download archives of our back catalog, or you can email Brian at airplanegeeks.com. That's Brian, if you'd like hard media. Why don't we tell everybody where they can find us online? Brian, I sort of already did it for you.
Yeah, I was going to say, since I'm still not being social, it's just Brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And David Vanderhoof, who's got some great posts recently on his blog. David, how do folks find you?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, which is slowly, the train is starting to leave the station and we're starting to post regularly on it. I've been motivated to write recently. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAVDigest.com.
And Max Trescott, Max West, where do folks find you online?
Well, this week, I think you can find me on the UAVDigest.com.
Yeah, can't wait.
Talking about my latest drone operator exam and license and all that kind of stuff this week. You can find Max Trescott with a T at Facebook and Twitter. And if you're interested in learning about the G1000 or IFR and glass cockpits, you can find my books at G1000book.com.
All right. And from Portland, Maine, our main man, Micah. How do folks reach you?
You can reach me by email at Micah@airplanegeeks.com. And I'm available on Twitter. And that's Maine Fly. Maine like the state with an E, Fly.
All right. You can find me on Twitter as Max Flight. Also look for me on LinkedIn, as you just heard, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. We've got an episode, a recent episode out. Check that out. Also, the Airplane Geeks listener team. You can learn more about that at airplanegeeks.com/team. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his great compositions that in very interesting ways incorporate aviation sounds. Find them at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Blue skies and tailwinds.
And thanks for listening.
Brian, what's this Eurofighter recording that you've got here?
It's just the engine. I recorded the Eurofighter taking off.
Well, let's listen to this.
And that was the Eurofighter taking off with full afterburner, or reheaters, as they call them here.
Well, that's
okay,
cool.
Micah and Brian, you need to stop. You need to drop the R. If you're going to use the British term, it's reheat. It's not reheater, it's reheat. Or just say afterburner. It's much easier.
There is a ugly-looking beetle-like creature walking across the ceiling above my head.
You're continuing from Thursday night?
Yeah.
We now have a bug of the episode night.
That's right. That's right. Because when we did the UAV digest, there was like the largest fly I have ever seen in my life. I mean, this thing, you know, half the size of a Cessna, kept landing on my screen.
I'm glad we just have earthquakes and forest fires out here. It's just
this fire's
so much easier.
All right.
Are you sure it wasn't from the CIA and it wasn't a bug? A real bug?
This one moves. I'm going to try to grab it. So you guys, you know, talk amongst yourselves or whatever. I'm going to try to speak. I don't know if I can reach it.
Yeah, take a photo of it.
Oh, it's too ugly.
We have to do these via video. I want to see that bug.
Oh, I hate it. Oh, I hate grabbing bugs.
Squish him.
I am. He's dead now.
And they're tasty, too.
Oh, don't even say that.
I hate grabbing bugs.